This is the Alembic Files, and I'm Al.
Theo.
And Eric's here.
Hey, guys.
And we're headed for part 11 of Phantasms of Freedom. Eric, you gave us a little bit of a blueprint for where we're going to go, but I'm going to let you take it over because I think it's more of a case of where we left off. So by all means, it's yours.
Okay, thanks. Good to be back. Yeah, the Whiskey Rebellion, the book that I'm plowing through now, I'm about three-quarters of the way through, and I will mention the title again. It's The Whiskey Rebels by Leland Baldwin.
Okay.
And he goes into an awful lot of detail. And the book, it is a page-turner. It's hard to put down. It reads like a novel, and it's loaded with details, a lot of different details of the players involved, the meeting places, the battles, where the people of the countryside were so incensed that anybody who sympathized with the Excise would have their barn razed, their house burned down, and basically thrown out of town, tarred, feathered, and run out of the community on a rail. There were several individuals who tried to mediate and moderate these passions. One of them is a gentleman named Breckinridge, who did collaborate with Freneau. Breckinridge was a writer. He was a justice on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. He was a lawyer. He was a judge. He founded the Pittsburgh Academy, which is now the Pittsburgh University. Pittsburgh Gazette, which is still operating today. It's a current day newspaper, Pittsburgh Post Gazette.
Yeah, they went ahead as what happened during the 80s. If you remember, there were a lot of mergers, and that was one of them. The Post Gazette, yeah.
Well, he was born in Scotland, and he came over to Pennsylvania with his family when he was five, and this was near the Maryland border. And he was, at the age 15, he was head of a free school in Maryland. I mean, this guy was pretty ambitious at a very young age. At 19, he entered the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton. And he did join Philip Freneau, James Madison, and others. They formed the Whig Society. And I guess they had a hard spot. They had a hair across their ass for the Tories. So they created a society to counter and challenge the Tories. The book that I'm reading that Baldwin wrote does talk about Breckinridge, who was really walking a tightrope. Actually also studied divinity, and he served in Washington's army. He was a chaplain, and he would get up on the stump and really rouse the soldiers, Rev War soldiers. And he, I didn't know this, he started a magazine, too, in Philadelphia. And, in fact, he published poems by Freneau. But I guess the subscriptions were lacking, so he ended up changing his profession, and he took up a law degree. He studied under Samuel Chase in Annapolis, and he was admitted to the bar in Philadelphia. He was 32 in 1780, and that's when he took his bar entrance.
I'm just curious. You named a lot of names there, and I just don't. I mean, they sound familiar to all of us. What I was going to ask you, is that the Chase that later became the Chase and Chase Bank? Solomon, is that?
Samuel Chase in Annapolis.
And by the way, the Breckinridges were pretty big in the development of Colorado, too. I wonder if it's the same family. In fact, there's a town out there by the name of Breckinridge.
Didn't know that.
Okay.
He was, the way Baldwin describes it, Breckinridge was, it seemed to me that he was in a quandary. He was trying to negotiate with some of these whiskey rebels, the country folk, and some of the commissioners who were heading up the excise tax collectors, these people who were going to collect the tax. He acted, the way I read it, he acted as sort of a go-between countryside people and the commissioners who were going to collect the taxes. And this guy, it almost appeared as if he was playing both sides against the middle. But in dealing with some of these principals who were against the excise and for the excise, this guy was, I'd have to call him a diplomat, really, that he didn't end up getting drawn and quartered. But he ended up, he ran for Congress. And he was a bit of an elitist. There's no doubt about that. He was at a dinner. Thomas McCain, Chief Justice, Breckinridge comes out with, who knows if he had a few or not. He said, quote, "The people are fools. If they would let Mr. Morris alone, he would make Pennsylvania a great people, but they will not suffer him to do it," unquote. So this other guy, Findlay, he published a missive of the remarks, and Breckinridge, he got defeated. So he almost got killed when he tried to mediate the Whiskey Rebellion as well. I don't remember a lot of the details. I mean, this book here, I'm going to have to read it through again to really let some of this stuff sink in.
But I mean, can we make the assumption that, you know, you mentioned Freneau, and you know that the work that JQ shared with us from Freneau and his circle of friends made all the rebels, especially those up in New England, the ones that were involved in the Shays Rebellion, it made them all sound like hooligans and absolute thugs. And while I think that was probably a caricature, but from what you're telling us about what took place out in Pennsylvania, now we understand at that time that was like the end of the world, right, the frontier.
Right.
And I'm wondering if those characters weren't a little bit on the hard side, if you know what I mean.
Very well could have been.
Well, I mean, if they're putting other people, I mean, their fellow town folk in between a hard place and a rock, I don't think I like that kind of strategy. You know, I mean, so the people in the middle are damned one way or the other. I mean, who do you want to get it from? You know, your neighbors or Washington and the boys? I mean, would that be an accurate assessment of what was happening with a lot of those people out there?
I'd have to say that some of the major players, it seemed that they had Federalist leanings and Federalist sympathies. You know, despite all the, what was that old saying, full of sound and fury signifying nothing, which really was how it ended up when Hamilton sent his boys, when he traveled with Washington, when he sent his boys to, and I think they called them the Watermelon Army. I haven't reached that point in the book yet, in Baldwin's book. But they basically scattered without a shot being fired. And I think what Hamilton wanted to do was sort of what would be today called a shock and awe. And he just wanted to show such numbers that nobody would dare challenge this behemoth.
Hey,
I mean, what's your take on this, Theo?
Well, Eric, actually, you mentioned two names that I know I came across in the history of the Supreme Court of the United States by Gustavus Meyer. So I'm scanning that right now, and I came across a couple of paragraphs that refer to Samuel Chase, and sure enough, okay, so Samuel Chase, he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He was a very rich person,
mm-hmm,
from a supposedly Protestant family, at least, in Maryland. He was a George Washington buddy. And get this, Chase fell into heavy debt at one time in his life, but the legislature of Maryland was accommodating. It passed a special act that if Samuel Chase conveyed a piece of property to a guy named Dorsey, that therefore Chase should be discharged from all debts, and that if any process was issued against Chase, it should be quashed. It need scarcely be said that, at this time, the iron laws against poor debtors were being ruthlessly enforced in all of the courts with steadfast rigor. But not against Samuel Chase.
But yeah,
for heaven's sakes.
And, okay, so yeah, he became a justice himself, did Chase. Oh, great.
Well, but you know what? But you see, I'm just... You know the penchant that there is in politics to blackmail somebody so they become your boy.
There you go. Yeah.
Right. Is that? Can we see that that might have been the case? Okay. Look, we'll absolve you, but you're on the court, and we'll tell you how it goes.
Yeah, definitely. How convenient.
And what was the other name you had, Theo? Did you have another one you said you came upon?
Well, yeah, Breckenridge, and he's somewhere in the same chapter, and I'm still scanning through it, so I'll let you know when I find it, if there's anything of interest.
All right, let us know. Our man in the man cave is going to look for it.
Hey, I'm in my little makeshift garage man cave out here.
There you go. All right, thanks, Theo. All right, go ahead, Eric.
Okay, I was trying to find in the list of the economic interests of the signers, but I don't see Chase's name in here. Let me see here. I see Daniel Carroll. This is from the book that Charles Beard wrote, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. This was published in, the issue I have is by the Macmillan Company of 1939. And maybe he was in early, or he was a Johnny come lately. He certainly did have a role in it. There's no doubt about it. But it doesn't look. Maybe Beard was unable to find any information on him. I don't know. But
could some of these guys have been signatories to the Constitution also?
Well, this was from the convention. Now, Theo, did you say that he was a signer? Would you repeat that? Was he a signer of the Declaration?
That's what Gustavus Myers has written here.
Okay, it was all right. I'm looking at the convention members. That's what I'm looking at. That's a different animal. Well, he did write some several works. Battle of Bunker Hill he wrote, and this was actually a blank verse tragedy. This was performance by his students at the Somerset Academy in Maryland. Where he was a master. And I guess it sort of featured these views by revolutionary leaders, the British, and sort of, I guess it was basically a, I don't know, maybe a morality play. He wrote the work called Indian Atrocities, Natives of the Perils and Sufferings of Dr. Knight and John Slover Among the Indians During the Revolutionary War, with short memoirs of Colonel Crawford and John Slover. It's S-L-O-V-E-R. And Knight and Slover's captivity narratives, often printed under various titles in other collections, including a selection of the most interesting narratives and outrages committed by the Indians. This was by Archibald Loudon, L-O-U-D-O-N, 1808. And this, he also wrote Modern Chivalry, 1792, this is the first two parts of Breckinridge's satirical novel. This is the first two parts appear in that. And he wrote several other works as well. His last was Modern Chivalry in 1815. This was a four-volume novel that he'd written. So this guy, he was quite prolific. He died in 1816 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He almost lost his life. He really played fast and loose. And he basically, it was amazing that he didn't get anything on him, so to speak, you know, other than his defeat. You know, it's amazing that he wasn't tarred and feathered, because he very nearly was. The Whiskey Rebellion itself, you know, I'd often ask myself, well, you know, why was whiskey so popular? You know, obviously it has entertainment value, but a lot of times guys back then were drinking rum, and I'm thinking, okay, well, it was the British blockade. They cut the blockade by the Brits. It stanched the flow of rum. And after that, whiskey just took off like a rocket. And it became the medium of exchange, like I'd mentioned in previous installment. And de Tocqueville, he visited, and he remarked that even cultivated Americans consumed whiskey with their meals, which often made after-dinner conversation, if not incoherent, frequently uninspiring. Sorry to disappoint you, guy, but what did you expect? So Thomas Jefferson, you know, the elitist, Washington, Jefferson wanted to promote winemaking. Washington wanted to promote beer making. And in fact, when Washington, here's another instance of his commercial interests, he became the country's biggest commercial distiller. Washington did.
Great.
Another example of just how many, you know, how many dollar signs this guy had in his eyes. And, you know, after, around the time of the, here's something I didn't know either, around the time of the War of 1812, the per capita annual consumption of alcohol was 8 gallons, which is more than four times the current level. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, these guys had a pretty hard scrabble life. I mean, you'd till the farm all day. You'd deal with the diseases of the time. I mean, after you worked from dawn till dusk, I mean, if I were those guys, I'd probably want to sit back and get good and shit-faced, too.
Well, tell us how you really feel.
Well, okay. Yeah, Breckenridge was dirty, all right.
He was?
Yeah. He was a judge who sat on some cases of land fraud in which he had a conflict of interest.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
What a surprise. Yes, I think Baldwin does. He touches upon that.
Okay.
Yeah, that he had his hands in several pockets, and he was getting his palms fairly generously greased.
This is from chapter 4 of that Gustavus Myers book.
Okay.
Getting back to the important stuff, which is the alcohol consumption. what I was going to say is, it probably was a daily drink. I mean, if you knocked a back a snifter or two, you know, coming in from the fields or whatever you did, I mean, that wouldn't seem really all that slovenly, if you will, you know. But I mean, you know, they go times that by 365 days, and maybe they took some days off. I don't know. I mean, I could see that happening.
It probably was medicinal too for
yes,
them.
Yes, very good point. I was just going to say that it was probably very clean as opposed to what's going on these days, and it was probably medicinal as well.
Well, that's true enough. And in my I take some blacksmithing classes at the Mystic Seaport.
Oh.
In fact, I'm going to be starting again next month. And some of the guys were telling me that the ships, the SS Morgan was recently, it was relaunched. It was refurbished. And I think it's the only original whaling ship left, and something like maybe 15 or 16% of the original wood is actually in the ship. What the guys would do is the water would go bad on the ships, and obviously, you know, salt water is, that's going to kill you quick. What they would do is they would spike the water with rum. It would be like anywhere from a 10 to 25% mixture, and that was grog.
Good old grog, okay.
Good old grog.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that, and it did have, definitely did have medicinal value. I mean, for cuts, especially in the days before antibiotics, I mean, that was a lifesaver. You know,
mm-hmm.
if somebody, especially, you know, out at sea, where these guys would be out from 3 to 5 years. No.
Even today, if you read some of the alternative health books, say, like by a doctor, Robert Mendelsohn, on some occasions what he suggested in his book was that the mom apply whiskey, you know, use a little bit of whiskey here and there.
And what would happen is, because it was such a medium of exchange, they had so much surplus corn, and they didn't really have an efficient method of transporting it, selling it. A lot of times what they do is they take the excess and they make whiskey with it. And it turned out to be a superb method of exchange. And that was one reason, in my estimation, that Hamilton wanted to put the kibosh on what I consider to be a fairly smooth-running operation as the hinterland was becoming, because they were sort of moving west. They were spurning the Constitution. They said the Constitution basically is a piece of crap. We don't like it. We don't want to follow it. And they were coming up with their own method of exchange. They were in essence, ignoring specie. They were ignoring the standard banknotes. It's just like the what we'd mentioned previously, the Massachusetts Bay Note, which were immune to inflation.
Well,
so Hamilton, I'm sorry, go ahead, Al.
No, I'm just going to throw that in real quick, and that is, and I think you remember this, the both of you. when I-Man was going through what was going on with the Massachusetts Bay Colony, that they were using all kinds of things for transaction. I mean, pelts and all this. I mean, useful stuff.
The commodities.
The staples of life.
Yeah, so I mean that's another way of getting around the monetary system, which was not appreciated, I'm sure.
Not at all. And these guys, what they would do is they would erect what were called liberty poles. And one, you know, they would have, say, six flags or so. And I almost go back to the obelisks. You know, who knew the significance of it? But they were the symbols of the resistance to this excise. They would call them liberty poles, and they were popping up all over the countryside. They'd have signs attached to them. Placards. They would have, streamers, and oftentimes the official or what you'd call government troops at the time would go in and they would knock these down. What's that, Theo?
I never heard of that. I didn't know that.
Yep, they were called liberty poles, and basically almost like a flagpole, maybe like a hewn pine trunk or a tree. And it's interesting because, you know, back in the day here in southern New England anyway, this was all conifer forests.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Brits came, they built a lot of ships and different cabins, and now you've got the maples and the oaks, and you don't really see that many conifers or pines around anymore. But many of these liberty poles they'd be erected, and they became a real sign and a real symbol of the rebels and the rebellion. And woe betide anybody who took one down. And there's some interesting stories in the book that Baldwin writes about, you know, how they treated what they considered to be miscreants. You know, take him out into the woods, cut off his hair. In fact, one guy got dragged to the local blacksmith shop where he was branded, tarred, feathered, and left out into the woods. You know, one guy ended up washing himself with soap, and he ends up coming back into town. And before long, he just took a powder. He was gone. But these people meant business. You know, they would have different meetings. There was the meeting of Bower Hill. There was the meeting of, what were some of the other meetings, Parkinson's Ferry. And like I said, I need to read this book at least one more time after this, because there are just so many details, and the players are just so numerous, and all the little things that went on behind the scenes.
Well, who were these people that were doing the vigilante stuff?
The locals, the local farmers, primarily poor farmers, were using the whiskey as their means of exchange. And what happened was, I'm sorry, Theo, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, wasn't being tarred and feathered, wouldn't that be life-threatening? I would think
so. Indeed.
Well, I mean, you'd have to have a certain percentage of body covered. I mean, is that what you're going for?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to tar somebody completely, I'm sure they knew that and they didn't do that. I mean,
okay,
you keep enough patches open, the body will still breathe. But, I mean, I don't think they were trying to – well, I mean, let's ask Eric. I mean, did you find any instances where they brought this to the point of fatality?
I didn't really see that. My sense is that they left part of the back uncovered.
Yeah.
And because it was more for humiliation than anything else. It was more sort of emotionally. I mean, what better way to emotionally geld a man than to do something like that?
I remember that scene from Little Big Man, the tar and feather scene.
Yeah.
Also the John Adams series, which was loaded with inaccuracies, but that was one part that it was indeed accurate, where they did actually portray a guy being tarred and feathered.
Okay.
These guys, because Hamilton ends up, he pulls, you know, here we have our friend, our good old friend Hamilton again, who really pulled a fast one. He didn't tell the locals about the requirement that the state had passed relaxing the judicial requirement of travel. In other words, if you were charged with something after this new, after these new rules, you would have to travel, like, from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. You'd have to travel hundreds of miles to answer in court, whereas the House at the time passed laws which relaxed that restriction. So instead of traveling 350 miles, you only had to travel 50 miles. But did Hamilton see it necessary to tell these people? Of course not. You know, he wanted to foment this. He basically wanted this this rebellion. You know, this dirtbag wanted all that so he could pad his ego and pat himself on the back. And, you know, John Adams, even, he was never a Hamilton fan. And John Adams called him, quote, bastard brat of a Scots peddler, unquote. And then on another occasion, Adams said, I remember the young bastard when he entered the army. And even after Hamilton died, this is what Adams wrote, quote, and listen to this prose. Listen to how these guys wrote back then, the level of education. I mean, even if it's bloviating bullshit, I mean, it's well-done bloviating bullshit. Quote, although I read with tranquility and suffered to pass without animadversion and in silence contempt the base insinuations of vanity and 100 lies besides published in a pamphlet against me by an insolent coxcomb who rarely dined in good company, where there was good wine, without getting silly and vaporing about his administration like a young girl about her brilliance and trinkets, yet I lose all patience when I think of a bastard brat of a Scottish peddler daring to threaten to undeceive the world in their judgment of Washington by writing a history of his battles and campaigns. This creature was in a delirium of ambition. He had been blown up with vanity by the Tories, had fixed his eyes on the highest station in America, and he hated every man, young or old, who stood in his way or could in any manner eclipse his laurels or rival his pretensions, unquote. Geez, John, don't sugarcoat it, huh?
Well, you know, if you watch the Civil War series that PBS ran, was that Ken Burns?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when he would write, or they would have an actor or actress read some of the letters, I mean, people could write.
They sure could.
I mean, it may have been a little baroque, but, I mean, they could write. There's no two ways about it. And, boy, hasn't that been lost. Now we're going LOL. It's like,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, but today, back then it was baroque. Today it's just broke.
Well, even the public schools, it was a whole different ballgame. It wasn't the public schools we know today.
No. It was the old community school. So, I mean.
There was true community representation. The community lorded over their own school, as opposed to just being a puppet of the feds today.
Well,
that's right.
And I can't see any community wanting to see that their children were shall we say, ill-schooled. So, I mean, I'm not saying it was a competition, but you don't want your child to be deficient. So I'm sure they did all they could to make sure that he and she had a proper education.
Yeah, not just teach it to the test.
Right. Oh,
a lot of that going on these days.
Oh, that's the only thing that's going on these days. It's a shame.
Yep.
I mean, I saw it. He sees it. He has to live with it. But, I mean, it's on education. It's, you know what it is? And I think you'd agree with this, and here we go. I won't go any further with this digression. What we have now today, wouldn't you agree, Theo, is basically Pavlovian conditional behavior conditioning?
I would not disagree with that. Nope.
Well, let me throw my 2 cents into this. The girlfriend that I mentioned, she went through all that stuff. Even back in the 80s, this was going on. Maybe not to the same degree, but it was happening then as well.
Now, let's face it. If you give somebody a 5-question test, you know, like, I'm not saying this is this facile, but, I mean, okay, red means what in a traffic, in a traffic light? I mean, if you give five questions and they get them all right, there's your A. That's where the Pavlovian stuff comes in, because you're only giving them a little tidbit, you know, dog bone.
And the schools know ahead of time what questions, or at least what category, what narrow category of questions are going to be asked, and so they emphasize that little narrow window of knowledge at the expense of everything else.
And to me, the supreme irony is that this devolvement in the public schools of education was in essence started by the Constitution itself, the way it deceived the people, the way it set up the governmental system, the way it established the hierarchy of power and deviousness. Really, when these people say, well, we need to improve education, we need to get back to the Constitution, they're basically talking out their asses because their mouths know better.
I don't know when, and maybe you do, Theo, I don't know when levels of government got involved in education. I don't remember where it all came from. We know that they came in with the Department of Education in 1979, but, I mean, I was already well through the public school system, and I don't know how much I got was dictated from perhaps, you know, Washington or whatever. Do you know? I mean, do you know when this started?
Yeah. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, I'm sorry, Theo. I was just going to say that all these things, Al and Theo, aren't they necessary and proper? Quote unquote.
What do you mean, to legitimize them?
Yeah, well, that was the language in the Constitution.
Well, I hadn't thought about that. I never would have laid it at the foot of the Constitution, and that's why I'm trying to think about when this influence really came in and whether I was a student of it without knowing, because I think Theo may be thinking the same thing also, and that is the free public education is a plank in the manifesto.
Yeah, one of the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto.
And that seems like a good thing, but it is because, I mean, it isn't because we understand what the free public system was like.
Well, it did happen, though, in steps, in gradations, after the, right after the Civil War.
Civil War, yeah, that's what I thought.
When it got started, the two states that are most to blame are Massachusetts first and then California strove very quickly to outdo Massachusetts. It was those two states. If you read the book that came out, oh gosh, in the late 1800s, the book is called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. Now, I know that doesn't sound like it's about what we're talking about, but it is. It's about the, oh gosh, how it was in praise of the community public schools, and it was warning people at that time in the late 1800s of the dangers and the inefficiencies of this new brand of government public schools at the federal level.
Yeah, cookie-cutter education.
Yeah, and okay, there's another essay, too, out there, if you can find it, that explains what happened. It's called Why the Schools Went Public, and the author is Blumenfeld. I think it's maybe Samuel Blumenfeld. Why the Schools Went Public. That essay is only about 20 years old, but the history is all there if you want to read those.
You know, and Eric, not to take it away, I mean, if you found this to be the fact with the Constitution, it's just something I never associated with it. But again, I think what we're talking about here is, and I think the reason why Theo came up with after the Civil War, and that's what I was thinking too, and that is you started to see a move toward federalization after the Civil War with the 14th Amendment. And I think that probably began some kind of regionalization. And as Charlotte Isabert used to lament with me, she goes, "You're in Florida." She goes, "That's the worst place." Because as I may have told you, Eric, I don't know, I know Theo knows, that the schools down here don't have town or community school boards. Every county is a school board for all those schools that are in it. And when you get that kind of regional government governance over the schools, people have very little say because you're just dealing with a monolith. And it shouldn't be that way, you know. So the whole idea of local structure is absolutely crushed. And as a result, we have one of the worst states for education.
They still probably keep the facade of it up, I'm guessing.
Of what?
Of local structure, local control of the school.
You know what? That's a very optimistic thing you said, but I have to tell you,
even
no.
Down there, they got rid of even the facade, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I said,
but here in Connecticut, it's still local control.
Yeah, and that's the way
it stay that way. I hope it stays that way.
Yeah, and it was in the way it was in Jersey, too. I mean, Florida's an anomaly, and it's not a good thing.
Right.
So, but anyway.
I don't want to be misunderstood. I mean, I'm not trying to paint the Constitution with a total broad brush, but, you know, it's the matter of looking at the origin and looking at the overarching federal behemoth that was created by the Constitution that really was sort of a pretext for the schools being taken over by the feds down the road.
That's why the Brits wanted the Constitution to get passed, because they wanted
and
to
also,
deal. Right. Good.
Oh, I was just going to say that that excellent simile that Royce used in Hologram about the dinosaurs being, you know, just slightly off balance. So it was what happened over the horizon, not right away.
And here we are.
Do you remember that?
Yep.
Okay.
Definitely. All right, so continue.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that let's let one of the anti-federalists speak to this. This is an anti-federalist paper number 40. This is sort of a compilation of points. And it says, on the motivations and authority of the founding fathers. This was done by Philadelphiensis. Quote, "It was a common saying among many sensible men in Great Britain and Ireland in the time of the war that they doubted whether the great men of America, who had taken an active part in favor of independence, were influenced by pure patriotism, that it was not the love of their country they had so much at heart as their own private interest, that a thirst after dominion and power and not to protect the oppressed from the oppressor was the great operative principle that induced these men to oppose Britain so strenuously. This seemingly illiberal sentiment was, however, generally denied by the well-hearted and unsuspecting friends of American liberty in Europe, who could not suppose that men would engage in so noble a cause through such base motives. But alas, the truth of the sentiment is now indisputably confirmed. Facts are stubborn things, and these set the matter beyond controversy. The new Constitution and the conduct of its despotic advocates show that these men's doubts were really well-founded. Unparalleled duplicity that men should oppose tyranny under a pretense of patriotism, that they might themselves become the tyrants. How does such villainy disgrace human nature? Ah, my fellow citizens, you have been strangely deceived indeed when the wealthy of your own country assisted you to expel a foreign tyrant only with a view to substitute themselves in his stead. But the members of the Federal Convention were men we've been all tried in the field of action. Say some, they have fought for American liberty. Then the more to their shame be it said, curse on the villain who protects virgin innocence only with a view that he may himself become the ravisher. So that if the assertion were true, it only turns to their disgrace, but as it happens, it is not truth, or at least only so in part. This was a scheme taken by the despots and their sycophants to bias the public mind in favor of the Constitution, for the convention was composed of a variety of characters, ambitious men, Jesuits, Tories, lawyers, etc., formed the majority, whose similitude to each other consisted only in their determination to lord it over their fellow citizens, like the rays that converging from every direction meet in a point, their sentiments and deliberation concentred in tyranny alone. They were unanimous in forming a government that should raise the fortunes and respectability of the well-born few and oppress the plebeians. Signed, Philadelphiensis."
Eric, that of all the anti-federalist writings you've presented, that is to me the most powerful, the most on point, and man, I would like to get a transcription of it and frame it.
Me too.
He nails it.
Absolutely, totally. That has to be the most powerful anti-federalist paper I have read so far. He comes right out and talks about the Jesuits.
Yeah.
Bang, right there.
You know,
and to
I,
me, that only shows, that only further buttresses just how on point, and I know people are going to say, oh, geez, he's talking about these guys again. I'm sorry, but credit where credit is due. The Informer and James Montgomery. Everything I've looked into, everything I've researched, further bears out the research that these guys did. And you know what? It all checks out.
Well, it isn't like they had one or two examples, that's for sure. I mean, it's not, I mean, it isn't always amount. But when you have so much a preponderance of information that has never been presented to the American public for obvious reasons. And so, you know, those who go and dig it out are looked at, and you know the deal. I mean, they get
right.
demonized immediately because obviously they've got something of merit and they did their homework to a T, you know, and there's no two ways about it. Also, I was looking, and I don't want to have to say this on the air, really, but I thought I had found, and I think I had asked you for it, but I had found it, but I'm looking now for a website that contains all the anti-federalist papers. Right. And also would allow you, Theo, if you wanted to take that and perhaps put it on parchment or something like that and make a pretty nice wall hanging out of it.
Yeah.
So we'll take a look for that. I'll come up with that site, but... The Federalist Papers are all over the joint, by the way. Did you ever notice that, Eric?
Yes, I certainly did. In fact, Al, I was at the Franklin Farmers Market up in this was in Coventry, Connecticut. This was at the home of Nathan Hale. This was at his family farm. And they had the museum, of course, and they had the Federalist Papers. They had the document, you know, the Constitution. They actually did have the Articles of Confederation, which kind of surprised me. But, you know, naturally they had the, you know, the people in period dress and all the stuff of myth that the average person would come in and see. And when I was doing Rev War reenactments, I mean, I was so into the myth and I was so taken with the fairy tale that I used to sleep in my revies. That's what I used to call them when I did Rev War reenactments. I was so taken with the myth that I slept in my revies.
Eric, I used to be so taken with that myth too. I mean, I grew up watching John Wayne movies and all that.
All right, but you see what we're saying here. I mean, this is why I think we're all in agreement that the word democracy has been warmly embraced by Americans, but democracy is not a good form of government. We're okay on that, right?
Yes.
All right, so how do you come across so that you can ensure that that is a good thing by the powers that be? And that is have a school system that bangs these children from the moment they can read with all this mythical stuff. And they go on with it. And so what you've done is you've propagandized a whole generation of children time and time again who have been taught this stuff. And now you've got a malleable mass that's your democracy. So, and it's what I'm saying. You know, if you can manipulate the mass, democracy works in favor of the government.
Now, one of those things that they include in the little snippets of propaganda and the banging on this is that tale about Nathan Hale. You brought him up, Eric. I remember thinking, hearing that story when I was a young boy, thinking, wow, what a hero. And nowadays, I was thinking about him about a week ago. I saw the name somewhere, and I was thinking, what a poor tool.
I'll mention the market itself was really, you know, they had the locally grown produce. They had, you know, just it was a wonderful event. You know, and it's a beautiful countryside. You know, that whole area is just gorgeous. But in stepping back and looking at the historical and the personage involved, sort of with the outlook and vantage that I have now, it just, it all looks so different.
Yeah, well, that's the prism of truth. My goodness, imagine looking at life through that. I just want to share something with you real quick. I was very fortunate, and so were you, Eric. I mean, in the time that I lived in Jersey near the New York state line, I mean, I was all over the Hudson Valley. I, you know, visited historical sites. Around where I lived, we had the trial of Major John Andre. You remember that?
Yes.
And, of course, he did get hanged.
Yep.
And we had West Point and all that. But I will tell you just really quickly, this was pretty stirring. I had a umpire a baseball game up at West Point. And at that particular day, it was spring. It was kind of – there was a fog coming up off the Hudson River because the river actually was warmer than the air. And they were practicing with this, like – fife and drum colonial marching band, and the sound of it and the drums banging off the valley and this mist and everything. I mean, you could look out to the Hudson, and I was working the bases so I could get the daydream a little bit. And I'm like, you know, I threw myself back to, like, just thinking about what it must have been like in the 1700s, the time of the Revolution. And I made eye contact with the first baseman, and I said to him, "That's something." He goes, "Yeah, isn't it?" He goes, "You know, we never get tired of that. I mean, that is something very special." So in being thrown back, in a sense, what I was trying to say, you know, for a colonial period at West Point, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that to a certain extent, you know, considering that was a pivotal point and one that Benedict Arnold wanted to throw over to the Brits, if you remember.
Oh, yeah. Well, and in a future installment, if it's fine, I'd like to discuss Benedict Arnold and, as I mentioned previously, the Battle of Fort Grizzle, and there was a fascinating article that came out in Military History, I don't have it handy, that really, I can't remember the name of the author, but he covered that battle, and the detail and the research were astounding.
You know,
and I will mention one thing about it that was kind of interesting, that it was a rout, the Brits routed the Colonials. And one of the reasons it's believed that the Brits had such ire and such venom towards the Colonials was because one of the Colonials during the battle, this was September 5th, 1781 or 91, I can't, or 86, I can't remember the year exactly, but it was in that neck of the woods. I believe it was 1781. A musket ball severed the flagpole of one of the Colonials. Now, in British tradition, if you were to throw your flag on the ground, that signifies surrender. The ball had cut the flagpole, sending the flag to the ground. Well, this Colonial picked the flag back up again after it had hit the deck. So the Brits saw that, and they saw underhanded tactics, and they just went for the jugular.
Underhanded tactics? Well, they invented most of them.
Of course they did.
Jeez.
But this was used, you know, this was, of course, this was a rallying cry used by the Brits. It was considered to be in violation of the conventions of the battlefield. There was so much more to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'd love to cover that, that whole battle.
Absolutely.
And, of course, you know, Benedict Arnold, he himself is a fascinating study. Dark Eagle.
Yeah,
in fact, he was born locally. He was born in Norwich.
And I think he's buried in Britain. He had to get his butt out of here after the war, didn't he?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
In fact, Peggy Shippen, his wife, I believe, Aaron Burr was his stepbrother. So they definitely kept it in the family. I'll have to look into that. I believe that Aaron Burr and Peggy Shippen were stepbrother and sister. But it's interesting that Hamilton, just go back to Hamilton here, that also Abigail Adams had a few things to say about Mr. Hamilton. Quote, "That man would become a second Bonaparte if he was possessed of equal power." And she wrote to, that's what she said about Hamilton. And then she wrote her husband, she wrote Johnny in 1796, quote, "I have often said to you, H is a man ambitious as Julius Caesar, a subtle intriguer. His abilities would make him dangerous if he was to espouse a wrong side. His thirst for fame is insatiable. I have ever kept my eye upon him," unquote. And then I guess after Hamilton was laying pipe with Maria Reynolds, and this affair became public in 1797, well, Abby wrote Johnny again and said, quote, "Oh, I have read his heart and his wicked eyes. The very devil is in them. They are lasciviousness itself," unquote. So even people of the day saw him and really kind of looked at him with a jaundiced eye. And this is from an interesting article that I will I'll supply the link with. It's pretty long, very detailed, a lot of good information here. And, of course, I have the article or the website with all the Anti-Federalist papers as well, and a couple of other articles, including the book that you had mentioned by David Liss, which is a novel.
Yeah, was it one of these historical novels, kind of fiction based on fact?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I have a review of that as well.
Well, we have a couple of minutes, so you want to hit something briefly?
Yeah. Yeah, I did want to mention quickly Shay's Rebellion, that they had found that not all of these Shayzites were poor or debt-ridden, dragged into the courts, you know, spent time in debtor's prison. So here's a question. Why were they involved in the rebellion? Okay, if they weren't indebted or destitute, then what? You know, and why would the uneven participation amongst towns or across towns take place? Well, what happened was it was all in the family, okay? Basically, family ties. You know, in most towns, the participation was concentrated amongst a small number of families. You know, somebody's son was involved, a nephew, a brother, a dad. You know, there were inducements to jump in because of a very close friend or more likely a relative. And they found something like 4,000 signatures of participants who were promised amnesty if they towed the line in the future, which I would like to get into more in a future installment. That there was a story behind Shay's rebellion, which I would certainly like to. I need to bone up on it a little bit more, but there are details about it as far as why it's called Shay's. Well, Shay's wasn't the only guy involved with fomenting it. There were others involved as well. Day was one of them.
Shay wasn't. The other guy was Day, wasn't it?
Luke Day.
Yes. Yep, Luke
well,
Day.
I mean, but to me, they had one of the most legitimate reasons to rebel. I mean, if we understand it being a fairly accurate account of what took place, I mean, these guys come back after fighting for the new country, and they don't have a chance to get their farms back up to speed, and they're being hit with higher taxes. I mean, if there is anything more ironic than that, that, you know, the supposed war was to throw off taxation without representation, and the first thing that happens while they take their uniforms off and get back to the plow, and it's heavier taxation. You know,
and one of the reasons is to cover for speculators too.
Now,
that was involved.
Wasn't that pattern of disgruntled former U.S. soldiers trying to, you know, put up a fight for themselves? Wasn't that repeated twice in the 20th century, and once in the very early 20th century, and the Veterans Rebellion was crushed by General Pershing? And later on in the 30s, another one was crushed by General MacArthur.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's where the benefits wanted by the veterans.
Yeah, vet benefits.
Well, I mean, that
there's a pattern of that in U.S. history.
And that's why when you mention the fife and drum, you know, those were the sounds to me, not for the elite money douchebags, but for the guys who were fighting and gals. Really, because they were supported by their women who were fighting on the front line at Brandywine, at Cowpens, at these different places. And as far as I'm concerned, those were the guys who really did have that independent. There were some, you know, the lower classes, the dirt poor farmers and the laborers. They're the ones who did believe
mm-hmm.
in the cause.
Right.
You know,
and
they were basically played.
Yes. And that's, and of course, this is one of those examples where they realized what was going on, and of course, that's more or less suppressed. I mean, it did make its way into our history books, but ever so briefly. And we're going to have to call it a day right there. I just want to add a couple of things before we all leave. One of the things I have to tell you is that right around West Point is Bear Mountain, and there's a lake there that is now called Hessian Lake. And one of the things I found out when I wrote an article for a magazine about the Hudson Valley, that the lake had been called Bloody Lake because there was a battle between the mercenaries and the colonial soldiers, and it was so brutal that the bodies that fell into the lake, because there was a mountainside right next to it, so there were so many bodies that fell into the lake that it actually turned the waters red. So
wow.
When Bear Mountain put a lodge up there, they thought that probably Bloody Lake wasn't going to be really good for tourists. So they changed it to Hessian Lake. At any rate, and Eric, forgive me, but guys, I just want to do something I haven't done before and close out the show with this, and that is I've not talked anything really about the website thinkorbebeaten.com that's up there now. For folks who are listening to our shows only because of Radio for All, you can go to the olympicfiles.wordpress.com.
Yes.
All right. I mean, we have the links there. But also, think or be beaten is kind of a salute to Angie. We do have a memorial to her there. We're getting the stuff up. Kelly is doing a great job as the webmaster, putting up all of Montgomery's and Iman's work that Angie had put in a repository of sorts. And we're bringing back some of the collections of archives, and there'll be free stuff up there. But also, this particular audio series, and along with JQ's, and Ominous Parallels and Lusitania, they're up there for free, and I think people should listen to that if you haven't before. So I'm sorry to do a little plug there, but I've not done it before, and I think it's time to unveil the website, you know, for a lot of good reasons. And one of them also is to memorialize Angie for all the work.
Here, here.
All right, guys, it's time to get out of Dodge. Eric, I thank you very much. Theo, also appreciate it. And we'll look forward to We know there's going to be a part 12, right?
You bet. Thanks, Al. Thanks, Theo.